Welcome to Sovereign Mind Radio Program, and I'm your host, Sonia Barrett, broadcasting from Inner Light Radio and BBS Radio, also from PSI Talk web station on Wednesday, June 25th, 2008, Matrix Time. Join me each Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time as Sovereign Mind explores the nature of the game, the game players, and the strategies in place to hold you spellbound and distracted. Informed guests will bring insight to the silent side of corporations, spiritual concepts, science, and technology, and how they're all being used to influence your choices. We will explore concepts and ideas that will stretch human imagination and potential. This show has been pre-recorded to accommodate the schedule of our guest, but you may also email your questions after the show, and we will be sure to forward them or have them answered. You can do that at innerlightradio@yahoo.com. My guest today is John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman and The Secret History of the American Empire. He has spent 3 decades as an economic hitman, business executive, author, and lecturer. John Perkins has lived and worked in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, and North America. Then he made a big decision. He would use these experiences to make the planet a better place for his daughter's generation. Today he teaches about the importance of rising to higher levels of consciousness, to waking up in both spiritual and physical realms, and is a champion of environmental and social causes. He has lectured at universities on 4 continents, including Harvard, Wharton, and Princeton. The Secret History of the American Empire zeroes in on hot spots around the world, drawing on interviews with other hitmen, jackals, reporters, politicians, and activists, examining the new geopolitical crisis and what can we do to change things for the next generation. Well, what I'd like to do is I would certainly like to welcome John Perkins to the show. John, welcome to Sovereign Mind.
Thanks, Sonia. It's great to be here with you.
Now, I want to make sure I remind our listening audience, again, you're listening to Sovereign Mind on Innerlight Radio and BBS Radio Wednesday, June 25th. Well, John, it's so good to interview you again. I had interviewed John for the magazine last year, and he has such phenomenal information with the kind of background that he's had. Seems like something that you would watch in a movie. John, I would like to actually start out by looking at a quote from you, actually, that I had picked up from your site. And it basically says, and this will actually also help the listening audience to really kind of get an idea as to where we're going with this. Quote, it says, that is what we economic hitmen do best. And you go on to say, we build a global empire. We are an elite group of men and women who utilize international financial organizations to foment conditions that make other nations subservient to the corporatocracy that runs our biggest corporations, our governments, and our banks. Like our counterparts in the mafia, we provide favors. These take the form of loans to develop infrastructure, electric generating plants, highways, ports, airports, or industrial parks. One condition of such loan is that engineering and construction companies from our own country must build all these projects. In essence, most of the money never leaves the United States. It is simply transferred from banking offices in Washington to engineering offices in New York, Houston, or San Francisco. Now, John, with all of that said, would you expound on that in terms of your beginnings and in terms of your, you know, your experience here? And I guess in the very first part of doing all of this.
Well, yes, you know, I think it's What you read is just very indicative. That is what economic hitmen do. And in the process of doing that, using World Bank and the sister organizations' monies to help our own corporations, and at the same time put these third world countries that have resources that we covet, like oil or cheap labor pools or diamonds or whatever, put them at our beck and call, basically making them subservient to us, because they end up owing us so much money that, and they can't repay their debts. So instead we ask for this pound of flesh, for a favor from them. And in that process, we've really managed to create the world's first truly global empire. And this is also the first empire in history that's been created primarily without a military. It's been created through economics. The military only steps in as a last resort.
Wow. Well, you mentioned something there, obviously the word oil. What I want to ask you is, with everything going on today, is there any way you can shed some light on the current conditions surrounding this oil crisis? I don't want to say exactly what is the strategy, but to some degree, there has to be something else in place besides just mere greed. What seems to be the expected end results of this economic game being played out? If you have any insight on that.
Well, there's a tremendous power struggle here. You know, the oil companies really want to control the supply of oil and therefore its price. The Iranians would also like to do that. And there's been this incredible struggle. We thought that by taking over Iraq, by going in and invading Iraq, that we would suddenly have access to its oil. The fact of the matter is, the Shiite groups, that led primarily by Iran, have really outsmarted us in that area. They very much won that war in Iraq for oil. We're not pumping oil. The United States is not getting oil out of Iraq. Iran is, interestingly enough. And if Iran ends up basically controlling Iraqi oil, which it's in the process of doing, as well as its own oil wells, it will control more oil than any other country in the world, including Saudi Arabia. That gives them tremendous power. They also have access to the Persian Gulf, to the main oil routes, which they could close down if they wanted to. So there's been this huge struggle. And it's not what we hear in the press most of the time these days, which is about the war in Iraq and maybe we'll invade Iran. The real struggle here is a much more subtle struggle, and Iran is really getting the upper hand. They've outsmarted us tactically and strategically in so many ways.
So basically then, I mean, John, I want to ask you real quickly, is there any way you can turn up your volume a little bit? It's a little bit low. I don't know if you can.
Well, you know, I've got a landline.
You know what? You're louder now. I think you're talking more into the phone.
I have to yell is what you're saying. You know,
oh, you're yelling.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm good at that.
I want to make sure that our listening audience can hear you clearly. Right. So, no, this is good. This is very good. So what it sounds like is I hear what you're saying. I think what's difficult is to wrap our heads around the degree of greed. It's how much can you possibly need to own? How much power do you really need to have? I mean, does this go beyond, just simply having all this money? I think that's what's so confusing. It's like, what can you do with all of this when you have so much of it after a while? What next?
Well,
is it just a game?
No, it is a game in a way, but since the demise of the Soviet Union and since detente, there's been one world superpower, the United States. And yet, we've dealt very unfairly with a great many parts of the world, the third world, Africa, Asia, Latin America. There's a real rebellion going on, a revolution. 9 countries in South America in the last few years have democratically voted in presidents who are saying, no, we're not going to be exploited anymore by the United States and by its corporations. And we're seeing something very similar in the Middle East. Iran takes great exception to the fact that we've been so favorably predisposed to the Saudi Arabians, who are Sunnis, and Iran is primarily Shiites, and also that we've been so favorably predisposed to Israel, and Iran is flexing its muscles. It's saying we've been treated unfairly. South America is saying many of the same things. Many parts of Africa are saying the same thing. So we became the superpower after the demise of the Soviet Union, and yet we've really abused that position. I think it's extremely unfortunate that we haven't taken the leadership in trying to support democracies around the world. Instead, we've taken the leadership in being greedy and helping our corporations become much richer and absorb resources from other countries. Those other countries now are extremely angry and frustrated, and they're trying to fight back.
With good reason. Now, with all of that said, what would your evaluation be? I mean, for me, this is a very curious situation in terms of the route that Chavez has taken, because obviously he's sort of decided to do everything he can to pay off his debt so that he doesn't owe anything, I guess, to the World Bank, and he's also investing funds into some of these other smaller countries. I know Jamaica is one, and is it Bolivia? A couple of these countries, but I'm curious as to, is the game, I mean, is he possibly then really playing a clear game? Is this sincere? Because there's so many games of control and power and greed that it makes me, yes, a little bit suspicious about, you know, what's in the backdrop of one's mind and concepts that are being put out.
Well, Sonia, during all of my lifetime, we've exploited Latin America ruthlessly. And today you've got 9 countries representing more than 80% of the population of South America who voted in presidents that are standing up and saying, we don't want to be exploited anymore. Chavez is the most well-known because his country has more oil than any of the others, and he's the most vociferous. But there are 8 other countries, and they've all been, their leaders were all democratically elected, and there's been there's been a real revolution, and it's been bloodless. Every one of these 9 countries, during most of my lifetime, was ruled by a ruthless dictator who was under Washington's thumb. And now the people have said, we don't want that anymore. We want independence. We don't want your foreign aid. They're all sending this very clear message. We don't want foreign aid. We just want you to allow us to use our own resources to pull our people up by our bootstraps rather than having these international quote-unquote free trade agreements that are so detrimental to those countries, that are so biased in favor of us. They're really putting their feet down. Chavez is the most well-known of these people. He's democratically elected. There's no doubt about that. Anybody who's observed the scene would say that. He's very unpopular with most Venezuelans in this country because they come from the wealthier classes and they've been taxed tremendously. They've lost a lot of their past businesses, but he's very popular amongst the poor people in Venezuela. And he's popular throughout Venezuela in so many other countries. He's looked at as a hero because he stood up to us. The CIA fomented a coup against him in 2002. He not only survived the coup, he basically outsmarted the CIA and stayed in power. And as a result of that, so many of these other countries have felt comfortable bringing in presidents who stand up to us. So he has performed a real leadership role there. I personally don't like his rhetoric. I don't like his demeanor. But he's a democratically elected president, and history's going to show that he's played an incredible role in uniting the continent.
Now, is there a possibility? I was going to, I guess my next question, I wanted to ask you what your feelings were on Cuba, because Castro has managed to protect the country from takeover. I mean, although the people basically were still, you know, prisoners to some degree, to a great degree. I mean, and I know they're very close friends. So is there any kind of that possibility in there at all, do you think? That same sort of Castro type concept?
No, I don't see that at all. Castro is a dictator. He took the country by armed force. And he's always been a dictator. He's never held any real elections. Chavez, on the other hand, won elections in 98 and has won many ever since, and many plebiscites. He lost one major referendum and agreed to it. He did not try to overrule any of it.
Right, I remember.
He's very, very different from Castro. Castro is a true dictator. Chavez is a democratically elected president.
Okay. Now, also, in terms of the World Bank, because I know most of the funding of a lot of these situations that end up being detrimental to these countries are, you know, funded, the corporations are funded by the World Bank. Can you talk a little bit about that, the role that they have played?
The World Bank has been very much a tool of U.S. corporations. It is a U.S. bank. It's not a World Bank. We have a controlling stock. We have veto power over all major decisions. The President of the United States gets to appoint the President of the World Bank. It is truly a U.S. bank, not a World Bank at all. And it has been used since the end of World War II, increasingly over time, as a tool of economic hitmen to provide funds for U.S. corporations to go into other countries and develop big infrastructure projects in those countries. So the U.S. corporations make a lot of money. The infrastructure projects like power plants and industrial parks serve a few of the very rich families in those countries primarily, but don't help the majority of the people who are too poor to buy much electricity, don't have the skills to get jobs in industrial parks. And then in the end, the country is left holding a huge debt that it can't possibly repay. And so, you know, somebody goes back in, an economic hitman, and says, you can't repay your debt, so vote with us on the next critical United Nations vote, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world, like Iraq, or simply sell your oil or some other resource, your diamonds or your coltan or whatever, to us very, very cheaply. So the World Bank has really been used as a tool of empire building, very, very smartly. And this has been done so secretly. You know, Sonia, throughout history, empires have been built primarily by military forces, and therefore everybody in the country knew you were doing it, the Spanish, the Germans, the Romans, the British, the French. Everybody knew that they were building these empires. They were proud of it. But we've said we're not empire builders. We're defenders of democracy. And we've, in fact, built an empire very, very secretly through economic hitmen, because for the most part we haven't sent our young men off to conquer these other lands. And I think that's very dangerous, because a democracy is built on the assumption that the electorate is informed. If the electorate doesn't know the most basic aspect of our foreign policy, as I've just described it, then we're not an informed electorate, and that really raises the question as to whether we can vote intelligently and, in fact, whether we can vote democratically.
You know, I actually have a question from a listener who happens to be listening in at this time, and it's George from Trenton, New Jersey. It says, hi, what about the campaign for the U.S. presidency? Who is John McCain? Who is Barack Obama? And who is Breznik, Obama's foreign affair advisor? I don't know how you can answer that question, but that's a question someone else has, I guess, in relationship also to what you just explained.
Yeah, well, you know, I think what's really important here is for us to understand that this empire building has occurred under both Democratic and Republican presidencies, and it's really up to us, the people, to change things. The president and every other elected official in this country is very beholden to big corporations. That's where they get their campaign money, either directly from corporations or from the major stockholders. The corporations pay tremendous amounts of money to lobbyists who wield incredible influence in Congress. And the corporations basically control our press, either through direct ownership or advertising budgets. We need to understand this. And we need to understand that whoever is elected president, we can't simply sit back and say, this man is going to set things straight. We have to do it. And we have to recognize that the real power these days are the big corporations. It's not our president. It's not the president of some other country. It's the big corporations. They are cutting deals with our own government and through lobbyists, with the Chinese, with the Iranians, with the Russians, with the Brazilians, with the Indians, with everyone. They really are in control these days around the world. That's how this empire has been created. And yet we have tremendous control over the corporations. They can only exist and thrive if we buy their goods and services. And we really need to understand this, you and I and Sonia and all of your listeners, that we have that power. And in fact, it's important to vote in these presidential elections and every other election, but it's also important to recognize that every time we shop or choose not to, we are voting. If none of us buys anything made in a sweatshop, there will be no more sweatshops. or sweatshops will be turned into legitimate factories where the laborers get a fair wage and health insurance and retirement funds. And so if every time you decide not to buy a Nike product because it's made in a sweatshop, you send an email to Nike and tell them why you're not buying it, you buy from somebody else and you send them an email and say you are buying from them because they're not using sweatshops, that has a tremendous impact. And we need to all of us understand that each one of us must take this responsibility. The next president is not going to turn things around unless we push very, very hard. You know, it's important to remember that some of the most important environmental laws in this land were passed under the Reagan administration. And he certainly didn't run on an environmental ticket, but he felt tremendous pressure from environmental groups at that time and passed the Clean Air Act and many other very important environmental laws.
Now, you mentioned the sweatshops, and that was going to be another question of mine. I know when we talked before, we had talked about Nike and Old Navy and the Gap. Would you say a vast majority of these corporations then, as far as clothing especially, I mean, everything else is, I'm sure, probably coming through there, but we tend to associate the sweatshop process with a lot of the clothing and things being made. Now, the majority, would you say, coming through these sweatshop arenas?
Unfortunately, yes. And it's gotten worse over time. And it's you know, we the consumer really have to take responsibility for that because we want to get things that are priced very inexpensively, and yet we also want these corporations to pay high dividends on their stock. And so, who suffers? And we're also very happy to watch sports teams make a lot of money. Big sports stars.
It's like crazy.
That. Yeah. Well, you know, look at Tiger Woods. How many millions does he need?
Unbelievable.
You know, we in the United States are willing to allow that to happen and to honor these people and put them on the covers of our magazines and also demand good products for cheap prices and high rates of return on our stock. I think what we need to do is turn this around now. We've been very successful at changing corporations, for example, getting the big corporations to clean up terribly polluted rivers in this country, get rid of aerosol cans that were destroying the ozone layer, get trans fats out of the food, as McDonald's has recently done, and take antibiotics out of chickens and cows and milk. We've been very successful at those things. Now we need to ratchet that up a notch, and we need to get the corporations to change their basic goal from one of being to maximize profits, which we've asked them to do in the past, maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs, and instead insist that they make profits but only within the context of creating an environmentally sustainable and just and peaceful world, a stable world. I have a 9-month-old grandson. I know he can't possibly inherit a good world unless every child born on every continent on this planet has that same expectation, because for the first time in history, we're a really, really small community. We need to recognize that and insist that our corporations play an active role or we won't buy from them.
And I think what you said is definitely so significant. I think, too, that we don't get the kind of exposure that is necessary here in terms of showing what actually happens with these sweatshops and that kind of thing. I think we hear of maybe situations that become severe enough where it can't be squashed and it'll come up and then it'll die down. But I think it was in reading your book, just some of the conditions outside of just even reading your book, some of the conditions that are imposed on these people that are working in the sweatshop. I think if most people really knew about it, I'm kind of hoping that they would actually really say, wait a second. You know, women who are having to stand all day and they're having their menstrual cycle, and I, of course, can't get graphic, but what occurs, what happens to them, I mean, because they can't take a break, you know, for a certain time, so they end up having to tie their sweaters or whatever it is around their waist. In the meantime, you know, they're a mess. That is just one of the one of what several dozen experiences that are
that's very graphic. You know, that these people who went over, I read about them in Secret History of the American Empire, and worked in a Nike sweatshop over there, Americans that are making a film of this, and found that, you know, every worker gets only 2 bathroom breaks a day, including women who are menstruating. And in addition to that, they're getting paid $2 to $3 a day for working in these factories, which is not enough to provide the basic life necessities. They have to live under very squalid and terrible conditions. And that, so that we can have, you know, relatively inexpensive tennis shoes, although Nike tennis shoes aren't particularly inexpensive, but so Phil Knight, the CEO of Nike, can make a fortune, and so can Tiger Woods, and so can the Boston Celtics and every other major team out there. And in the process, we're creating an extremely dangerous world for ourselves and our children and grandchildren. We must turn this around. We simply must do it. We ought to do it just to be just, to do what our sacred documents say we believe in, government of, for, and by the people. But in addition to that, it's the most pragmatic thing we can do, the thing that serves our best self-interest, because if we keep on this course, our children and grandchildren are going to inherit a very, very dangerous and difficult world. And if we can just turn it around and do something better, we have the opportunity to create quite a magnificent future for our children and grandchildren.
Absolutely. And I say that it would help tremendously if some of these sports figures had the courage to say no, because it's not that they need the money, but to say no to those, to some of these endorsements that are doing, you know, that are impacting on other people's lives. But, you know, it seems like no is not a word that's in there.
Well, if every one of your listeners, every time they watch a sports event, would send an email to that team that's wearing the Nike swoosh and point this out to them and say, you know, if every one of your listeners, every time they watch a sports event, sends an email to whoever the heck it is, you know, whether it's Tiger Woods or the Boston Red Sox, or I'm from New England, so I keep going back to Boston.
Right.
But whoever it is, send an email to that team. Send an email to that individual. If they get flooded with these emails saying, stop wearing the Nike swoosh until Nike agrees to do a better job, I'm not out to destroy Nike. I want to see Nike continue, but I want to see Nike be a leader in social rights, in taking care of their laborers. There's nothing wrong with us paying Indonesians and Filipinos a decent salary, but let's make it a decent salary. You know, let's give them a fair salary, and let's give them health insurance, and let's give them retirement funds so that they won't become terrorists.
Yeah, basically just doing the humane thing.
Doing the humane thing and recognizing that it serves our best self-interest, because otherwise we're going to have a lot more terrorism on our hands than we currently have. You know, I've known a lot of terrorists, Sonia, over the years. I've met with them. I've written about them. I'm a handful, but I've met enough of them that I know that I've never met one who wants to be a terrorist. I mean, there may be some crazy fanatical people out there that want to be terrorists, but the majority of them are desperate people who've lost their homes because they've been flooded out by hydroelectric projects or destroyed by petroleum sites, oil drilling sites, or for one reason or another, they don't have any source of income. And so they're desperate people. And when an Osama bin Laden or somebody else, charismatic, crazy leader comes along and says, okay, pick up a gun and start shooting people, they do it because they really don't know what else to do. We need to take that away. We need to take that incentive away by giving them decent jobs and decent pay and decent health care.
And, John, of course, I'm going to sort of go backwards a little bit. Now what I'd like for you to do is, would you give some true insight into how you how economic hitmen are truly brought about? Is it through, you know, the colleges? I mean, the universities. I mean, what is the process that has one recruited to move into that zone?
You know, there's so many different approaches, so many different routes a person would take. Sonia, I can talk about my own. You know, I was in my last year at Boston University Business School, and you know, I was recruited by the National Security Agency, the nation's largest and probably most secretive spy organization, They put me through a whole series of tests and identified me as a person who could do this kind of work well, and also someone who had what I think you'd call the three main drugs of our culture, which is a desire for power, money, and sex. I had all of that going for me, and I explained in the books my own personal background that led me to that. And then they hooked me, basically. But I never did anything illegal as an economic hitman. What I did should be illegal, but it's not. It's sanctioned. By our business schools. I've been asked to speak, as you mentioned earlier on the show, and I was at the time. I was an economic hitman at places like Harvard Business School and Wharton and so forth. I was lauded, patted on the back by Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank. It was held out that what I was doing was good stuff. And you get that same thing. You get people working for Nike today that know darn well that the people that they're hiring for $2-3 a day in these sweatshops can't live good lives on it. But somehow they justify this because there's a whole barrage of human resource experts and psychologists sitting there telling them, look, it's better that they make $2 or $3 a day than nothing, which incidentally is not true because they pulled off of subsistence farms where they actually had fairly decent lives. They made their own food and they made their own clothes. They produced their own food. They didn't have any income. And suddenly they're off at $2 or $3 a day. This sounds like a fortune to them. They don't realize that they can hardly live on it. They can no longer produce their own food. They can't make their own clothes. And then 2 or 3 years later, the factory closes down, moves to a place with a cheaper labor pool, and they're left absolutely destitute. But there's a whole barrage of people in these corporations, as there were at my time with economic hitmen, that are convincing them that, you know, they're doing the right thing. And you get seduced because you're making a darn good living. You're traveling first class around the world. You got a great life. Your kids are going to good schools. And somebody's saying, hey, this is good stuff you're doing. And you want to hear it. You want to believe it. So you fall into that trap. You know, I was lucky. Some things happened to me that made me become enlightened, that I realized how bad it was. And I got out, and I'm spending the rest of my life devoting it to trying to turn this around. I feel sorry for the people that are stuck in those positions and have really succumbed to them.
Now, were you aware of what you were getting into, though, in the very beginning?
Well, yeah, I had this mentor, this woman who trained me, Claudine, who was extremely skilled, extremely seductive, extremely intelligent, and she told me that basically what I was getting into, but she also told me that what I was doing was not illegal, and that it would, you know, by creating investments in these huge infrastructure projects, we'd actually see the statistics of the economy growing in these countries. The economy did grow. But what isn't told to you is that while the economy is growing, only a few rich families are really benefiting in most of these countries. The poor people in these countries are not part of that economy. And so they're getting poorer. And the percentage of poor is getting much greater, and the percentage of wealthy is getting smaller and smaller. The middle class is dwindling more and more. And that's the opposite of what's supposed to be happening, which is to help the poor raise themselves up by their bootstraps. It took me a number of years to really understand that that's what was going on. And once I fully understood it, and once I fully understood that there were these jackals out there waiting to assassinate leaders that didn't go along with our system, then I got out, and because it became obvious to me that we were doing something very, very bad and ultimately very self-destructive to ourselves, something that would create terrorism and animosity around the world. But it took me a time to learn that.
So basically, your job was more so to go in and be as convincing then, I would imagine, as possible to ensure whatever the process would be, whatever the government here, the system here in the U.S. wanted the government to transform to. That was your job, right, to basically convince them to do that. And if not, then they ran the risk of having a jackal come in.
Right. I would tell people like Jaime Roldos, the president of Ecuador, and Omar Torrijos of Panama, you know, take this huge loan from us. And the money's going to come back to our corporations, but it's going to subcontract parts of the job out to your brother-in-law's company that owns the John Deere franchise, or your sister's company that owns a pipeline outfit, and so your family's going to get very rich off this too. And you know, a few rich people are going to benefit from these big power projects. The people who own the big industries and the big skyscrapers in the wealthy cities, they'll benefit. But the rest of the country is going to be left with a huge debt. You don't need to say that, but they know that. And, and at the same time, you tell them, listen, you know, if you don't go along with this, well, remember what happened to Salvador Allende in Chile, and to Arbenz in Guatemala, and to Lumumba of the Congo, and Mossadegh of Iran, and Diem of Vietnam, and so on and so forth. You just run off a list of presidents that didn't go along with us and were either overthrown or assassinated by our jackals. And every one of these presidents knows that history. They know about these things. So you put them in a very, very difficult position. They can either try to stay in their job as president and basically take a bribe from you and take on these huge loans for their country, or they can realize that you're going to become their enemy and you're probably going to throw them out of power or get them assassinated. It's a really tough position that they find themselves in.
Yeah, because there's a documentary I watched recently called it's Life and Debt, I think, and it has to do with the impact of globalization in Jamaica. And I know Michael Manley, the ex prime minister, was saying that same thing, that these countries are given their freedom. I mean, they received their independence, I think, in 1962. They're set free knowing that they will end up becoming enslaved at some point again, back to whichever, you know, the U.S. or whichever system is in place that's going to move in on them. And that's what's happened to Jamaica. I was really shocked. How can an island where vegetation grows naturally, how can you have to then import such things like onions and potatoes? Farmers are not able to make any money anymore because of this. It's amazing.
Right. Well, it's these trade restrictions or the subsidies that we have on the products here in the United States that makes it cheaper for a farmer in Mexico, for example. A cotton farmer in Mexico can actually produce cotton a lot cheaper than our farmers here in the United States can, but our farmers are subsidized. So when they sell their product, you know, in Mexico, they can sell it for cheaper than the Mexican farmer can produce it, which is outlandish. It's outrageous. And, you know, I think what we all need to understand is that this is going on all the time and that our country is doing these things. And it's creating a very, very dangerous world for all of us and not the kind of world we want. I don't think any American really wants to see this going on. So we really need to understand it and insist that it no longer continue. Insist that we support our most sacred documents, you know, that the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, government of, for, and by the people, and realize that we've got to move out of this adolescent worldview that we've been under for centuries now, that the only way for us to get ahead is to exploit other people. That's the old way. And it perhaps was the only way that worked in the past, but no more. Now we've got to move into a more mature recognition that we're a very fragile species living on a very tiny planet. And we've all got to get together and realize that we're part of one community. And that if Indonesia is suffering, then we're going to suffer here too. And that we've all got to pull together and work to create a more sustainable, just, and peaceful world for all of us.
I agree, John, and I think one of the things that us as parents, and it's kind of hard for parents to emphasize that if they are also doing the same thing, but I think is to teach our children not to buy into this consumerism concept, because that's what's fueling or what's allowing all of this to take place is the greed for whether it be designer named items or whatever the case may be. But the consumerism concept, I think, just drives people to want and to find a way to get something, you know, regardless of what the situations are behind it.
Yeah, well, Sonia, here we are. Today, in the United States, we represent a little less than 5% of the world's population, and yet we consume more than 25% of the world's resources.
That's crazy.
It's crazy, and if you look at our social statistics, we're not very happy. We have the highest rates of drug abuse and child abuse and homicide and incarceration, divorce and suicide. I mean, our social statistics are abominable. What that tells you is that this materialism is not bringing us happiness. I spend a lot of time in Latin America. I speak Spanish. I just came back from there. I go there all the time. I have godchildren there. And, you know, you can walk to people who are statistically speaking impoverished, but they lead pretty good lives in the Andes or the Amazon and many other places where they're living off subsistence, and they're happy people. They're not committing suicide. They're not alcoholic. They're not beating up on their children. There's a lesson here to be learned, and that is that there's something that we're really missing out on here, and we need to understand that and really go for what it is that makes us happy.
John, I have another question actually just came in from Delford Hunt in Pittsburgh. Do other countries have their own economic hitmen, and has a hit been put on a leader, a president here in the U.S.? What about Nelson Mandela coming out of prison and becoming the leader in South Africa? I always thought this was fishy. I don't know if you have comments on that.
Well, there's hits all the time being put on people. I can't speak directly for Nelson Mandela because I don't have personal experience there, and I don't like to speculate except where I have personal experience. But I will say that I just was recently in South America where I met with a number of the new presidents or their staff down there, and every one of them has said and gone on the record, and some of them hold my book up and say, yes, this is happening here. The hitmen have come in and offered us big bribes and also threats. We know that we sent a hit team down to take out Chavez in 2002. It was a coup staged against him. It was a CIA supported coup. There's no question about it. And he fought it off. He outsmarted the CIA and stayed in power. So this type of thing goes on continually today. A huge threat right now. The thing is, there's so much revolution now, peaceful revolution. 9 countries in Latin America, then a more violent revolution that's obviously going on in the Middle East, that we're reaching a point where I think the United States, the corporatocracy that runs all of this, is throwing its hands up and saying, my God, what do we do now? Because we can't take out 9 presidents in Latin America. We're losing badly in Iraq. We're losing in Afghanistan. And so... we really see an empire that's in the throes of collapse. But I don't want to see this empire collapse. History shows us that empires always collapse, and when they do, you get a void, you get wars, and a new empire emerges. We don't want a new empire to emerge. What we need to do is something that's never been done in history before, and that is transform this empire into a real viable model that sets a new tone for the world, that says, yes, let's move forward. Let's use our phenomenal success in the marketplace, our corporate success, our political success, to create a world that's based on producing living conditions for everyone that are environmentally sustainable, just, and peaceful. Let us be the leaders in that. We still are world leaders. Our language is the most spoken language in diplomatic and commercial circles of any language in the world. Our arts are leaders. Our radio, our music, our television, our movies. Let's use that to guide this next stage of development out of that adolescent viewpoint that colonialism and exploitation is not the only way, into a more mature attitude that we all must work together to produce a better world. I'm very optimistic, Sonia, that if we all set our hearts and minds on this, or if a critical mass of us does that, then it will happen. And I think it must happen.
I agree. I agree with you, John. The last time I talked to you, I know that we had talked about the U.S. and the environmental conditions. And I know that the U.S. was working at improving all of that. We were behind in relationship to Europe and other countries. What would you say, as far as a measuring factor, would you say our position is now on that scale in terms of the improving the way we view the environment and changes to the, just the whole eco system?
We're still a laggard. There's no question. It's abysmal. You know, it's terrible that we constantly say, well, we won't do it unless the poorest nations in Africa also do the same thing. That's such a crazy way to look at it. We are the world's largest polluter. Again, less than 5% of the world's population, creating more than 30% of its pollution. And we all talk these days about all the pollution that comes out of China. Yeah, well, China has a huge population, much, much larger than ours, but on a per capita basis, we create a lot more pollution than China does. China's actually gets stricter environmental standards for its automobiles than we do, and for many other things. I'm not justifying China, but I'm saying we really need to take a leadership role here. We still are resisting the Kyoto Protocol. We are very, very backward in this sense, and it's time we turn that around and really took a leadership role in it. I do see that in the last few years there have been some significant changes, and that every corporation I know of is talking about being greener, and I think trying to become greener, at least in limited steps. The Walmart's a great example. A couple of years ago, they never even considered being green, and now they're adopting a much greener attitude. So that's true across the line. So I think we are getting better. I think the American people are becoming more conscious, more aware. There's been a lot of books, a lot of movies, including Al Gore's amazing movie about this, including movies like Blood Diamond about Africa and Hotel Rwanda and The Constant Gardener, that are exposing these things. So I think Americans are finally becoming much more aware of this, and so are corporations. So I'm very optimistic, but we've got to keep pushing, Sonia. We don't have a lot of time here. If we want to create a world that our children and grandchildren are going to be proud to inherit from us, we've really got to push this thing.
And one of the other things, too, that I'd like to bring up, and I want to bring it up because I don't know that many people are aware of this. And this was information from your book as well. But this has to do with Ecuador, the lawsuit that had been filed for what had been done by the oil companies. I think it was Chevron Texaco Corporation, and I'm just going to read this quote real quickly. The oil giant dumped into open holes and rivers over 4 million gallons per day of toxic wastewater contaminated with oil, heavy metals, and carcinogens that the company left behind nearly 350 uncovered waste pits that continued to kill both people and animals. I'm bringing that up because I think not to continue to just emphasize what we would recognize as the negatives, but I think that if people don't realize just how severe certain things are, it doesn't really hit home.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and
I
so...
mean, yeah, it, go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, Texaco has destroyed huge, huge amounts of the Ecuadorian Amazon and killed a lot of people, and then Texaco now is owned by Chevron, so the largest environmental lawsuit in the history of the world has been filed on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorian people, all living in that Amazon area, against Chevron Texaco for this. And, you know, it's something I think most of us don't realize. But these companies have been extremely, extremely abusive, knowingly, wantonly doing this. There's no question about that. And yet, we all have to take a certain responsibility because we've wanted oil prices to be low. We've decided that we don't like people drilling offshore on the coast of Florida, where I live, or California.
Right.
We don't want big oil derricks in our backyard, but we're very content to have them be put in very fragile environments like the Amazon or the Sahara or other places. We need to be aware of the terrible costs of that around the world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It slipped my mind. There was something that I was going to ask you real quickly, because we're close to out of time anyway. When you mentioned about the prices, the gasoline prices, do you see that is this necessary? I mean, obviously none of us think that this is necessary for the prices to be as outrageous as they are. I mean, what do you think? Is there a point coming soon where any of this will drop, or will it, you know, remain at this increased level and just taper off? I mean, we're at like $5 basically a gallon here in California. Are they going to taper it off at this crazy amount?
No, I don't think it's going to taper off. I mean, I can't see any reason why it would. We haven't built any petroleum refineries in this country for something like 30 years. The war in Iraq has basically taken supply out of Iraq. We're not taking oil out of Iraq. Iran is holding back certain amounts of it. China's demand has gone up tremendously, and we're also looking at the whole idea of oil scarcity, peak oil. So the best prognosis is that it's going to continue to rise, and we're going to have to adjust to that. We're going to all have to drive much more fuel-efficient cars. We're going to have to become much more efficient users of oil. We need to realize that oil is a finite resource at some level, and that there's a lot more people on the planet demanding it now. Every time we get more economic growth in places like China, there's a greater demand for oil. And also it's becoming a huge political football and a speculative football. So there's tremendous amounts of speculation going on out there, too, which tends to drive the price up. So I don't think we can plan on the price going down, Sonia. I'm no expert on oil price forecast, but I do read what the experts are saying, and it appears to me that we can't expect that. And if I look at it logically, too, I don't see where we would, the only way that price of oil is going to go down is if either the demand gets reduced significantly, which means we're going to be using a lot less of it, or supply increases. I can't see where supply is going to increase. So the only other alternative is for demand to decrease, and that means we've all got to use a lot less of it.
Well, you have said more than a mouthful, John. And really amazing information. And I would love for you to give us any information on any additional events. I know you said we just missed San Diego. Do you have any events coming up? There are people, of course, all over the world that are that listen.
Yes, I have a lot coming up, a fall tour. I just got off the spring-summer tour, and I'll be beginning a fall tour soon. The best thing to do would be to go to johnperkins.org, go to the events, section of the events page of johnperkins.org, and everything is listed there, and we're updating it constantly.
And John, any final words? I think you said a lot of final words there that weren't final, but any advice?
Be optimistic and take action. It behooves all of us to get away from the television set or whatever else is preoccupying us and really take action and let these companies know. If you buy a Prius, let that company know why you're buying it, because you appreciate the fact that they're conserving fuel for you, and let General Motors know why you're not buying one of their cars, because they haven't done that. And whenever you buy anything, be very conscious and let the companies that you don't buy from know why you're not buying from them, and the same with the ones that you do buy from. And we just all need to take action. It doesn't take an awful lot for things to happen. We've seen huge turnarounds. We've seen organizations like Rainforest Action Network with a staff of 20 people and a budget of $2 million a year bring about, get some of the biggest giants in the world to stop cutting rainforest trees. We have tremendous power. You and I, Sonia, and everybody listening to us tonight has tremendous power to influence the people around us by the way we talk, by the way we eat, by the way we shop or don't shop. And so don't get discouraged, but do be aware and do really work hard to create a better world for future generations.
Well, thank you so much, John. That was John Perkins. Thank you for coming and sharing your amazing insight and giving us hope and courage. And, of course, to our listening audience, thank you again for listening. And, of course, you've been listening to Sovereign Mind. Join me next week as my guest will be Peter Moon, one of the authors of the Montauk Project. You may contact me, Sonia, S-O-N-I-A-B-A-R-R, at yahoo.com. And you may visit my website at www.sovereignmindradio.com. Join me next Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember, that the power to be a free mind lies with you.